Disclaimer: this episode of Dead Souls may contain graphic descriptions or audio recordings of disturbing events which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
According to the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation, at any given time, there is on average between 25 to 50 serial killers operating within the continental United States. The US also has the highest amount of serial killers per capita in the entire world. Everyone knows what a serial killer is. The term is commonplace in everyday life. But prior to the 1970s, when the phrase first emerged, it was unheard of. The term, that is. The crime it describes was very much not a new phenomenon then. In fact, the phenomenon started a hell of a long time before the relatively recent 1970s. Within the United States, there is one name that is generally attributed to be the first. He wasn't actually the first, but the volume of sensationalism attached to his name has meant that he was pinned with this label over time. There are many stories about H.H. Holmes floating about out there. He's been called the Beast of Chicago, the Torture Doctor, and the Devil in the White City. And those monikers just about sums up the sort of man that he was. It was probably inevitable that such a monstrous life as he lived would get wrapped up in myth and legend. In Holmes' case, though, many of the stories central to his mythos are entirely baseless fantasies and outright lies. They were concocted by newspaper reporters of his day, as well as sensationalist writers in later years. Their accounts tell us more about the susceptibility of the public to lurid and melodramatic media than they do about Holmes and his crimes. This isn't surprising, considering the age in which Holmes became famous, although very little, if anything, has changed in that respect. In the 1890s, newspapers were the alpha and omega of mass communication. Competition for readership was fierce. Daily warfare between the black and white tops was being waged in the United States by publishers like William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer. Snaring a reader's interest was considered much more important than reporting on the facts. Truth took a back seat to subscription numbers and that sweet, sweet advertising revenue. Remarkably, even when you cut out all the lies that have been told about Holmes over the years, what remains is still enough to place him among the vilest villains in American history. He was a murderer, a con man, and a polygamist. He killed adults and children without showing any hint of remorse or having any kind of conscience. Students of criminology can learn a lot by studying Holmes. In fact, students of history too, so long as they proceed cautiously. After all, it's always wise to be fully aware that you are wading into murky waters, of course. Although be thankful that he's no Albert Fish, I suppose. Holmes was, first and foremost, one hell of a liar and a con man. Whilst in prison later in life, Holmes self-penned his autobiography, but it was eventually established to have been a tapestry of lies. Within the pages of the book, at least four people he claimed to have killed in a so-called confession, that he also sold to newspapers, by the way, they turned out to be alive. He turned his lies into careful tactics, in fact, whereby his chief legal plan at trial was to shroud truths in falsehoods to muddy waters, leaving the prosecution and jury entirely confused and assuming horrid truths were exaggerated rumours. Sifting out that truth is therefore no easy feat. Fortunately, a resurgence in interest in Holmes in recent years has led to a new wave of excellent historical research by a number of credible sources. The man who came to be known as H.H. Holmes was actually born Herman Webster Mudgett in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, in 1861. Contrary to imaginative tales of animal torture, his mother later told reporters that her son had actually been kind to all creatures when he was a child and teenager. He especially liked dogs. Fun fact. Torture of animals at a young age is often attributed to being characteristics and behaviours of a future psychopath or serial killer. Whilst it is true, to an extent, that criminologists and the FBI look at childhood animal abuse as a major red flag, it is a predictive warning sign rather than a guaranteed outcome. Whilst criminology historically linked animal cruelty, fire setting, and persistent bed wetting as a trio of indicators that led towards adult violence through what is known as the McDonald Triad, this is now considered a fairly outdated viewpoint, with modern psychology viewing this as an indicator of severe childhood trauma rather than a direct roadmap to becoming a killer. But back to Holmes. One challenge Holmes faced in early life was a strabismic left eye. Strabismus is a medical condition that involves poor control of the eye muscles. Many people commented on Holmes' inability to look them directly in the eye, but this was a physical deficiency, not a mental health or psychologically attributable condition. By all accounts, Holmes was a charming conversationalist, quite the captivator actually. I suppose you have to be if you're going to be a con man or confidence trickster. Holmes went on to marry at least 3 women in his lifetime, so he must have been considered attractive enough for the time period, right? He sported a hell of a moustache, if that's your thing. Anyway, a compulsive womanizer, he also conducted several extramarital affairs. I have read that several historical researchers have stated that it's possible that Holmes' embrace of, shall we say, free love, may have been a case of overcompensating somewhat. This is based on a doctor who examined Holmes while in prison, and he stated, on record, that H.H. Holmes had a penis which was slightly on the small side. Do with that information what you will, although, personally, I'm having trouble understanding why the prison doctor felt that he had to A. check on this, and B. document his findings. But there you go. Even though Holmes was trained as a surgeon, he practiced medicine only briefly before moving to Chicago. It was in the Windy City where he made his fortune by running small-time con jobs. The move happened in 1886, which was also when he started signing his name officially as H.H. Holmes. Prior to this, he used a number of temporary aliases such as Alexander Bond, Harry Gordon, J.A. Judson, and Robert E. Phelps. The initials stood for Henry Howard, or Harry H., when he bothered spelling them out in full. Changing names was part of a dizzying number of schemes Holmes tried in Chicago. For instance, he often rented bicycles or antique furniture and then stashed them away to sell on for cash, defaulting on the rental agreement from the very start. Holmes would obscure his identity, which helped him avoid paying these rental bills, though he did become the subject of numerous legal challenges or lawsuits over the years. Holmes owned a pharmacy, or a drugstore to my North American friends. It was located on the northwest corner of South Wallace Avenue and West 63rd Street in the Chicago neighborhood of Englewood. Contrary to popular belief, Holmes did not take over the store after murdering an elderly doctor and his wife. The store was in fact sold to him by a young doctor and her husband, who both outlived Holmes by decades. Across the street from the pharmacy, Holmes had another building constructed, the second floor of which comprised of a baffling maze of rooms, some of which the media later assigned colourful names, such as, quote, the Room of the Three Corpses, or the Asphyxiation Chamber. Popular theory is that Holmes designed this building, his so-called murder castle, so he could slaughter victims away from prying eyes. But based on the historical record, it's more likely that he made the building complicated to confuse bailiffs or court-ordered repossession agents. There were doors leading to nowhere, and rooms concealed behind false walls. A businessman, who wanted to use the building as a hotel, reported finding rooms stuffed with furniture that seemingly appeared and disappeared overnight. This actually ties into another legend about the castle, that Holmes opened it to guests during the 1893 World's Fair. Dozens, if not hundreds, of fairgoers were said to have been gassed in their rooms, then lowered by ropes into the basement, where Holmes indulged his passion for dissecting corpses. The problem with this story, though, is that there is no evidence that the castle took in a single World's Fair guest. Prior to the fair, Holmes rented the building to the aforementioned businessman and his partner. But after a month, they got sick of Holmes' shady dealings and left early. Records indicate that Holmes spent the next several months overseeing construction of a family home in another part of Chicago. In August 1893, a fire at the castle rendered the third floor uninhabitable. The fire was likely set by Holmes himself, meaning he cared more about collecting the insurance money than anything that he'd been doing on the third floor crime-wise. Which is not to say that he didn't kill people at the castle, of course. But when he was arrested for a murder committed elsewhere, evidence came out that he was guilty of at least 8 other killings. The castle played host to 5 out of the 9 murders that researchers consider canonical. The murder for which Holmes was caught and put on trial for was that of Benjamin Petersell, the most prominent of 2 men who were thought to have aided him in his criminal enterprise. In a lesson about choosing your friends carefully, Petersell had plotted with Holmes to defraud an insurance company. Holmes used his medical connections to obtain and partially mutilate a dead body and would then go on to claim the body was Petersell's. He would then help Ben's widow obtain the $10,000 insurance money. You'd think that if Ben really knew Holmes very well, that he would have seen the flaw in his plan from the very start. But being a heavy drinker and a born stooge, he was probably not the brightest accomplice that Holmes ever had. Figuring it was easier to pass off a real dead body than a fake one, Holmes then killed Ben Petersell by knocking him unconscious with chloroform and setting his body on fire with berezine. He also went on to murder Petersell's son and 2 of his daughters for reasons that he never fully explained. The 3 children were placed under Holmes' care after he manipulated Petersell's wife into allowing him to take them on and also convinced her to allow him to collect her husband's insurance. 13-year-old Alice Petersell, 9-year-old Nellie Petersell, and 7-year-old Howard Robert Petersell. After 6 weeks of travelling throughout the United States and Canada with the 3 children, Holmes eventually locked them in a large trunk, drilled a small hole into it, and piped in gas to asphyxiate them. Maybe the best thing that could be said for Ben is that his dull wit helped convince Holmes that he would get away with a pretty dumb scheme. The story of Ben dying in an accidental explosion was eventually challenged by the insurance company. Holmes was later investigated over this fraud and would be ultimately hanged on May 7th, 1896, just 9 days shy of his 35th birthday. Even though Holmes had been suspected of killing strangers, his canonical murders were all of people whom he knew. Indeed, statistically, around 76% of all murders are committed by someone known to the victim, so this aligns with common averages. As with Ben Petersell, Holmes seems to have chosen death for his victims any time it was easier than leaving one alive. He never considered anybody's feelings but his own, as we can see by looking at each of the murders committed in the castle. The first canonical victim was Julia Connor. Holmes employed Julia as a clerk in the jewellery shop that was part of the pharmacy he owned. Julia's husband, Ned Connor, worked as a jeweller and sometimes managed the store for Holmes. The couple lived for a small time at the Holmes murder castle. Julia and Holmes began having an affair. Julia's marriage thus broke up and Ned left, leaving Julia and their daughter Pearl behind. Julia and Pearl seem to have lived fairly happily in close association with Holmes and the castle's friendly janitor, Pat Quinlan. But like Ben Petersell, Quinlan later became known as a close ally and accomplice of Holmes. He was good with tools and had a strong back, I read in a few places. Like it's a normal thing to say about someone. Oh yeah, Pat, I know Pat. Lovely fella. Hell of a strong back. Quinlan reported to his wife and daughter, who were friends of Julia and Pearl, that Julia had moved to California with a new husband. This was just before Christmas of 1891. Other tenants at the castle reported seeing the two on Christmas Eve in the building, however. But after that, they were not seen anymore. Later, and at various times after his imprisonment, Holmes claimed that Julia had died on the operating table, essentially meaning that he either killed her intentionally or by accident while performing an illegal abortion. Actually, maybe he killed Julia some other way. There were, after all, no living witnesses. What Pearl Connor, who was only 6 years old, had to do with her mother's botched surgery is anyone's guess, however. Pearl is often falsely reported as being 12 years old in some sources, but she wasn't. Years later, when the castle basement was dug up, the bones of a child about Pearl's age were discovered. They were the most incriminating evidence against Holmes ever found at the site. Pearl was most likely poisoned, possibly smothered, or strangled by Holmes. Did he have moments of conscience after killing a child? Well, we can get an idea of how he felt with what he did with Julia and Pearl's property, I suppose. Weeks after their disappearance, he tried to rent out the rooms which they had occupied. Clothes and personal items were strewn about. According to the new tenant, these included a doll that Holmes kicked under a bed. Holmes actually offered to give the new tenant the clothes, and when she declined, he had them shipped off to his own home. Modern accounts of H.H. Holmes often call him, quote, America's first serial killer, which is a reasonable claim if you're mostly concerned with the number of people he killed. But we typically imagine serial killers as having some sort of twisted motivation behind their crimes. David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, said that his neighbor's dog ordered him to kill, whilst Jeffrey Dahmer just didn't want his young male visitors to leave. Ever. But again, Holmes may have committed killings that did fit this mold, but the ones we know about have fairly pedestrian motivations. His third canonical victim, Emmeline Sigrand, mirrors Julia Connor except for a few details. She was unmarried, not a mother, and didn't live at the castle, though she certainly visited there. Like Julia, Emmeline worked for Holmes before becoming romantically involved with him. When she disappeared in December of 1892, Holmes said that she had gone off to get married, much like Julia. In his later confession, however, he said that she died in the same way, a botched abortion attempt with Holmes holding the knife. Pat Quinlan, the janitor, played a part in Emmeline's story too. The day after she was last seen, Quinlan helped Holmes and another man carry a large crate from the castle. This was reported by the same witnesses who saw the clothes left by Julia and Pearl a year before. I don't know about you, but I'm surprised she stuck around and survived for a whole year, mind you. Set side by side, the murders of Julia and Emmeline look like the acts of a narcissist, desperate to protect his fake reputation. The killing of little Pearl is harder to fathom, though, but it does fit the profile of a psychopath. Driven by ego and lacking empathy for others, Holmes killed to get out of small hassles and obligations. If he was a serial killer, you would expect him to kill for the sake of killing, out of triviality, or from basic sexual desire. So, did he? Well, the last of his canonical victims at the murder castle don't appear to have presented the same sort of inconvenience that motivated the other murders. There was money to be made from the death of his mistress, 24-year-old former actress Minnie Williams. An impediment may have been removed by killing her sister, Nanny, but Holmes never had trouble taking financial advantage of living victims. Holmes and Minnie seem to have been well matched. Her name appears on several deeds for his property, and she's known to have sold property that she owned to turn the money over to Holmes. That money would have gone into schemes and swindles, as all of his money did. If Minnie was a willing investor, as well as his, quote, bit on the side, then why kill her? Well, according to Holmes, he didn't. But Holmes claimed a lot of things. Holmes said that it was Minnie who was the murderer. He claimed that when Nanny came to visit the castle, Minnie got jealous and struck her sister with a stool, killing her instantly. Holmes disposed of the body and helped Minnie flee the country. Thanks to a letter Nanny wrote on the 4th of July 1893, it's safe to say she did meet Holmes. She probably went with him to the World's Fair while Minnie was away. And given that Nanny was female and present, Holmes almost certainly gave her a shot, so to speak. He just couldn't help himself. So Holmes' tale of a jealous assault has some credibility to it. There are reports of a violent barroom brawl in another state involving a vicious woman named Minnie Williams. It's not known if she was the same Minnie, but what are the odds of another woman of the same name coming along and triggering an emotional response from Holmes? On the other hand, telling the truth was so unlike Holmes. It's easy to believe he killed both sisters. Though neither were confirmed to have been seen after July 5th, 1893. The next day, several financial transactions were carried out on behalf of Minnie, all to the benefit of Holmes, I might add. Aside from a completely bogus newspaper confession, Holmes stayed remarkably consistent in saying that he hadn't killed either Williams' sister. We don't know how the sisters died exactly either. And the most profit that Holmes made doesn't seem like much of a reason why, especially given how eager Minnie was to help him lie, cheat and steal. The Minnie Williams episodes are perhaps the most mysterious part of the whole H.H. Holmes story. I'm reading between the lines to say that Holmes wasn't solely motivated by money. If he was, he could have made a fortune by running a number of legitimate businesses successfully. He seems to have cared far more about getting away with crimes. Almost like a sport. One way or another, though, Holmes turned a corner with Minnie and Nanny. He had always been a schemer. Schemes involving murder now took a fresh appeal to him, however. If we can believe a minor detail in his autobiography, he had been considering high-stakes insurance fraud for a decade before he took the plunge. There had always been a missing ingredient, a lack of which made his plans too dangerous to implement. Necessity may have been that ingredient. Chicago had gotten too hot for Holmes since the insurance company started investigating the Castle Fire. Moving would mean leaving several sham businesses behind, so he may have wanted big money fast. But H.H. Holmes' back had been against the wall before. Rather than necessity, habit may have driven him to kill Ben Peterzell. And having gotten away with a string of murders, he'd learned he didn't have to make a murder a last resort. If he was careful and smart, he could save himself trouble by planning the murder from the start. 1894 was a busy year for H.H. Holmes. In January, he left Chicago and his second family to travel first to Colorado, then on to Texas. Whilst in Denver, he laid claim to some money that had been owed to Minnie Williams. Also in Denver, Holmes married once again. This was his third marriage, if you count only the wives that he didn't kill. So counting Emmeline Sigrand and Minnie Williams brings the total to five. With his new bride, Georgiana Yoke, Holmes went to Fort Worth, Texas, where he attempted to reinvent himself as a sort of fast-talking Jesse James. Financial security was to be provided by Ben Peterzell's life insurance. That fat $10,000 policy that I touched upon earlier. Well, it had been taken out months before, with Holmes paying the premiums. It was at this point that Holmes made two crucial mistakes. The first was stealing horses in Texas. The second was blabbing about his insurance scheme whilst in jail. The horse theft was duller than it sounds. He borrowed horses and sold them, just as he had borrowed and sold bicycles and furniture before. But horse theft? In Texas? He should have known better. His second mistake happened after he left Fort Worth to hide out in St. Louis, Missouri. The same old hustles that worked so well in Chicago got him into immediate hot water there. Though he had a shot at building up a new pharmacy business, he decided instead to rip off his suppliers. The St. Louis establishments weren't used to these sort of shenanigans. Holmes was arrested and jailed right away, and while awaiting bail, he met a criminal hero of his and asked a favor that he would come to regret. Marion Hedgepeth, a train robber famous for the shine on his shoes, shared a jail cell with Holmes. Probably feeling that they were kindred spirits, Holmes bragged about the insurance scheme to Hedgepeth. "Hey, if you can't trust a fellow criminal, right? Anyway, Holmes asked if Hedgepeth knew a lawyer dirty enough to want in on the action. And as it happened, Hedgepeth did. He gave Holmes the referral, but later flipped on Holmes in the hope of getting time knocked off of his sentence. It didn't work, but that was no comfort for Holmes. For clarity, Hedgepeth didn't get time off his sentence. He was eventually paroled in 1906, went back to crime, and got shot holding up a Chicago saloon in 1909. Let's just call him a victim of the Holmes curse too. I briefly touched upon the murder of Ben Petersell earlier in this episode, and I just wanted to touch upon it a little more, specifically how the murder actually played out. Well, Ben Petersell moved to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in August 1894. On September the 1st, Holmes visited him, killed him, and rigged the scene to look like an accident by the aforementioned methodology. Or at least he tried. So thus, chloroform knocked Petersell out, then Holmes broke a bottle and singed Petersell's hair, leaving a match nearby to suggest that he had accidentally been overcome by the fumes. When the body was found 3 days later, the doctor at the scene said it simply couldn't have been an accident. A second party had clearly been involved, he made clear. Still, there was no evidence tying who that second party was to Holmes. What happened next is possibly the most sinister part of the whole affair, though. Carrie Petersell, Ben's widow, knew about the scheme in advance. Like her husband, she had been told that the body involved in the scam would not be Ben's, but a substitute cadaver. To claim the insurance money, Holmes needed a family member to identify the rotting corpse. When Carrie fell ill unexpectedly, Holmes turned to 13-year-old Alice Petersell to make the identification. At no point does he appear to have asked Alice to lie. So this can only mean that he meant to kill the girl. If not from the start, then at least from very early on. Anyway, Alice ID'd her freshly dead dad by his teeth. The insurance company cut a fresh check for 10 grand, and the crooked lawyer Holmes had hired took $2,500 of that. $300 was spent on expenses, whatever they were, and all but $500 of the rest went to Holmes. He alleged that he had financed a purchase for Ben and not been paid back. That purchase? Well, it was a Fort Worth property owned by one Minnie Williams. If Holmes was driven by greed, he could have walked away at this point with $6,700 in his pocket. Instead, he set out to exterminate the Petersells, because of course he did. Making a clean sweep would free him to resume life with his current wife under one of his many former aliases. But again, it's not like he hadn't started over before. Was he so taken with Georgiana Yoke that he couldn't let her go? Or was he driven by complicated passions, or simple bloodlust perhaps? Either madness or genius was necessary for the chase he kept up over the next several weeks. He moved the Petersells in two groups. Mum, Carrie, and two kids were one group, Alice with her brother and sister the other. Holmes and Georgiana moved separately. None of the groups were aware of the movements of any other, though they visited the same cities, often riding the same trains at different times. Only Holmes knew they were on each other's trail. Philadelphia to Cincinnati to Indianapolis to Detroit, with stops in between. Toronto, Canada and Ogdensburg, New York. Carrie went there, she was told, because her husband was supposed to be waiting at the end of the tracks. Holmes said that Minnie Williams was taking care of Alice, Nellie and 7-year-old Howard, while Carrie rode the rails. Carrie didn't know Minnie had been dead for more than a year. She also didn't know her children were staying in hotels within miles of her own. Holmes kept a collection of letters from mother to children and vice versa. Occasionally, he even delivered letters. Some he likely wrote himself, copying phrases he had heard from the children, whom he soon finished off. Howard was the first to go. He was fed poisoned eggs. Teeth and chunks of his skull were found jammed into the flue of a stove in a rented house years later. We already know how Alice and Nellie met their demise. They had been stripped naked and buried in a shallow, half basement. Holmes described running gas into the trunk he locked them in. Screaming and banging, Holmes calmly listened as the screaming got quieter until it stopped altogether. The method of the burial is known too. Holmes borrowed the shovel from a neighbor, saying he wanted to make a place to grow potatoes. But in a move that puzzles investigators to this day, Holmes then took time off from killing to visit his hometown. His first wife, Clara, was still living there with their son, Robert. Holmes was still legally married to Clara, and Robbie was 15 at the time. The Mudgetts hadn't heard from Holmes in 6 years. He sent a letter saying that he had recovered from amnesia, and just like that, he was welcomed back with open arms. Even the news that he had married a lovely nurse who tended him after a railway accident didn't put a dampener on the lovebirds' reunion. Do you get the feeling that he just wanted to see how much he could get away with? It's like he spent his whole life trying to glitch the Matrix. I actually once knew a guy who was like that. He committed awful crimes and a lot of people asked why. What were his motives? As it transpired, he didn't really have a motive. He just thought he could get away with it because of who he was. Almost like he was invincible. Maybe I will do a deep dive episode about him soon. Let me know if you'd like to hear about it. I won't tell you who he was just yet. The peace that Holmes sought at home didn't last. Holmes was busted in Boston, where he'd taken Georgiana to finish their vacation. She had enjoyed the trip so far, staying at the best hotels, going for nights at the opera, ignoring the chemical smell her husband carried around with him. It was the Pinkerton Detective Agency who brought Holmes down, though, in cooperation with the Boston Police Department and investigator W.E. Gary of Fidelity Mutual, the insurance company who had paid for Ben Peterzell's death. Train robber Hedgepeth had spilled the beans by this time. The crooked lawyer likewise confessed to irregularities. A long list of fraud victims were found who stood ready to condemn Holmes' character in court. So quick that it might have been a reflex, Holmes confessed to insurance fraud. Ben Peterzell wasn't Ben Peterzell, he said, just some dumb corpse. Newspapers of the day picked up the cover story and ran with it. Hell, it was just a few years after the Jack the Ripper murders in London. The press was hungry for another one. In fact, there has been some speculation that H.H. Holmes was actually Jack the Ripper himself. Opinions and theories over the years is pure speculation, however, pushed entirely by media sensationalism and the great-great-grandson of Holmes, currently alive and well in San Diego, California, and looking to raise his profile, shall we say. There is no evidence or historical fact to the speculation, however, and Holmes wasn't even in London at the time of the Whitechapel murders.
Could two of history's notorious serial killers actually be one man? A San Diego native who can trace his roots back to one of those is convinced.
And he spoke only with our 10 News anchor Lindsay Pena tonight. She shows us the evidence he says proves it.
Growing up in Coronado, Jeff Mudgett never knew the dark secret lurking in his family's history.
I was 40 years old when my grandfather dropped the revelation on the entire family.
And it was a bombshell. Mudgett's great-great-grandfather was none other than H.H. Holmes, also known as America's first serial killer. By all accounts, Holmes, born Herman Webster Mudgett, was an evil genius, a skilled con man who used his medical background to help him carry out horrific crimes.
The Murder Castle basement was something right out of Mary Shelley and Frankenstein in America.
The now infamous Murder Castle stood at the corner of 63rd and Wallace in Chicago's Inglewood neighborhood. Holmes built it as a hotel just in time for the Chicago World's Fair of 1893 and is said to have preyed on unsuspecting visitors who checked in and never checked out. Although Holmes himself confessed to murdering 27 people, Mudgett believes that number was much higher.
I believe it was a couple hundred at least. Eric Larson does too, from Devil in the White City.
The Devil in the White City brought Holmes back into the spotlight and became a best-selling book. But Mudgett believes there's another chapter to his great-great-grandfather's story. History Channel's American Ripper followed Mudgett on his quest to prove Holmes was also responsible for another string of gruesome crimes.
Jack the Ripper was the Chicago doctor H.H. Holmes.
Jack the Ripper terrorized London's Whitechapel neighborhood in 1888, killing at least five women. The bodies were mutilated with surgical precision, indicating the killer had an extensive knowledge of the human anatomy, something Holmes definitely possessed.
Anyway, from November 1894 to July 1895, fragments of truth were uncovered in relation to the Petersell death. After being transferred to Philadelphia and charged with murdering Ben, Holmes claimed Minnie Williams was keeping the children. He had the district attorney place a coded personal ad asking Minnie to get in touch. This was all pure theater, of course. Minnie never came forward. The Chicago murder castle's strange construction was discovered, and an excavation was ordered to begin on July 20th, 1895. Very quickly, the trickle of press interest turned into a flood. Clumps of ash were mistaken for rib bones and reported as such. Lists of possible victims were written that included the living and the dead. It's a mistake to think television invented the media circus. Crowds flocked to the murder castle, spurred on by newspaper coverage and lurid headlines. On Sunday, July 28th, almost 5,000 gawkers were turned away by police from outside the murder castle, while 100 were allowed to trample the crime scene before police managed to gain control of the scene. Over the months that followed, the bodies of the Petersell children were found. A lawyer for Holmes managed to convince the judge not to allow evidence about any murder but Ben Petersell to be discussed in court. It was one of the defense's only victories. 12 jurors convicted Holmes of killing Ben Petersell, and all of Holmes' following appeals were denied. When he stood, at last, on the gallows, he insisted once more that the only lives he had ever taken were Julia's and Emmeline's, during their botched surgeries. Then he was dropped to the end of the rope. According to a doctor who observed the hanging, Holmes died instantly of a broken neck, though his body twitched for several minutes before ceasing to move. A long-standing rumor, widely shared for decades, was that Holmes had escaped his death. He was alleged to have bribed guards and priests to hide him from witnesses while he swapped places with a dead body. Though the story was never taken that seriously, the rumor that he lived to wreak vengeance on people associated with his trial persisted until only fairly recently. Jeff Mudgett, the great-great-grandson of Holmes, attempted to prove the rumor in 2017. In a televised excavation, Holmes was unearthed from his grave.
Also new this morning, the body of a suspected 19th century serial killer who was born here in New Hampshire is being exhumed in Pennsylvania. The great-grandchildren of Henry Mudgett, also known as H.H. Holmes, hoped that identifying his remains will quell rumors that he conned his way out of execution. Holmes is believed to have killed several people at his so-called House of Horrors during the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. But it was the murder of his Philadelphia business partner that led to his hanging in 1896. A judge said that the remains must be returned to the same grave after DNA testing, even if they do not belong to Holmes.
The exhumation involved consulting old records of where the grave actually was, since it was no longer marked. The excavators had to dig through concrete. Holmes had feared his body would be desecrated, so he took extreme measures to protect it. I'm not sure why he felt this was necessary in death, but there we are. After the excavators dealt with some extra protection Holmes had put in that scholars didn't even know about, his DNA was found to be a close match to Jeff Mudgett's. As it turns out, H.H. Holmes was in the grave and had been dead this whole time. Unsurprisingly, rumors about Holmes didn't stop when he did. Sloppy reporting and deliberate myth-making continued to mislead the public for decades to come. Holmes is remembered today mostly for what he might have done, rather than the crimes he actually did. Ironically, his portrayal as a supernatural figure serves as a distraction from his very real and horrible crimes. He destroyed at least a dozen lives, counting the devastated family members his murders left behind. That's plenty. His reputation and history doesn't need to be inflated. It's vile enough as it is. Holmes doesn't need to be a supervillain. He doesn't even need to be a serial killer. He was kind to animals. and not a bit shy, after all. There's one last myth I'd like to share about Holmes. It's a line that he is often said to have written himself. He allegedly said, quote,
"I was born with the devil in me."
Well, he didn't actually write that or say that. It's an exaggerated summary of a meandering paragraph that had no talk of the devil in it at all. However terrible his crimes were, Holmes didn't need cloven hoofs and a tail to conceive them. He was a man who told lies with every other breath, who hated earning an honest wage when a crooked one would do just fine. He was a man who thought he was smarter than everybody else, or at least just about. So how did he get to be this way? Well, Clara Mudgett, his only legal wife, once wrote to a criminologist that the news of the murders had been hard for her to believe, stating, quote,
"But of course, he worked himself up to his most awful crimes little by little, and I think, having done some little wrong, he had been driven to a greater wrong for a cover, each one growing worse and worse. Of course, it is easy or more easy to go in the wrong direction after the first few steps."
When put that way, it's almost possible to see how a person could step from one lie to another, down the devil's path, as it were. For those of you interested in further reading and perhaps taking an even deeper dive into H.H. Holmes, I highly recommend H.H. Holmes, The True Story of the White City Devil, published in 2016 and written by true crime expert and renowned historian Adam Seltzer. This book is perhaps the gold standard for all things H.H. Holmes. It's available in audiobook format too, for some gentle bedtime listening. Another hell of a great read is The Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic and Madness at the Fair that Changed America, written by Eric Larson and published back in 2004. This book, in actual fact, is one that brought Holmes back into the limelight after decades in the cold. And although it depicts some events as they could have been rather than how they probably were, it's still a fascinating insight into quote-unquote America's first serial killer. Again, there's an audiobook version of this title out there to make things a little easier to take in if you prefer. For the record, I'm not sponsored to recommend either title. Larson's book has also been in development over at Disney, of all places, to turn into a movie directed by Martin Scorsese and starring Leonardo DiCaprio as H.H. Holmes. The last I heard, it was struggling in development hell though, so how soon we will see it is anyone's guess. Finally, last point I'll make here, the H.H. Holmes autobiography, whilst is out of print, is available to read for free on the United States Library of Congress website. I'll put a link in the description of this episode. Dead Souls is researched, written, produced and hosted by me, Jamie Black, with music by Mark Butler and Coag. Dead Souls is not part of any network or corporation and is entirely independent. Therefore, our views are completely free from any bias or censorship. For more information about our show, follow us on Twitter at DeadSoulsCast and Instagram at Dead_Souls_Podcast. If you want to support the show, you can do so by going to patreon.com/DeadSouls. For $2 a month, you will get access to exclusive ad-free episodes only for Patreon supporters and exclusive access to written articles, blogs and research. You may have noticed that sometimes our podcast doesn't appear on your YouTube feed, and very often our podcasts get age restricted or removed altogether. This isn't by accident. We cover topics that are not always algorithm friendly, and the big corporations don't love it when we talk about certain topics or have certain conversations, especially the kind that challenge mainstream narratives. This is another reason we have created our Patreon. It is a space where we can post full, unfiltered and uncensored topics that the big platforms and mainstream media don't always like. Proceeds from our Patreon go directly to supporting us, our show, our research and keeping the lights on here at Dead Souls HQ. Go check it out. patreon.com/deadsouls. That's it, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Good night, everyone.